repeated what we have said earlier. But if we want to say that, okay, what are the two key features of Imam? Universality of his government and justice.
All right.
You see that all the, let's say, even freedom seekers, not only in Islam world, but also in non-Muslim world, when they wanted to come to actually to have the support of people with them, they had the motto of justice with themselves.
So we even see that today, like whosoever speaks at the election campaign, the one word that gets very bold is justice.
Yeah, we are coming for justice.
Yes.
Definitely.
Well, I don't think that's been seen in the world right now, and it won't be seen until Islamic, the divine ruler, Imam Mahdi Ajallah Ta'ala Faraj is going to come. Thank you so much, Dr. Alavi, for being with us. We'll discuss more with you in upcoming sessions. Dear listeners, since we are talking about justice, a very beautiful hadith from Lady Fatimah Zahra Salamun Alayha came into my mind, which says, justice is obligatory for the peace of hearts. So do not break hearts. Do not disturb the peace of the hearts, because that's going to be one of the obligatory things that you are breaking. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to the IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
No one is illegal.
Part 2.
Me trajeron aquí mismo.
I was brought here to Tarifa, to this center. When we got here, it was very late at night. We were all in handcuffs. Around 20 police officers stood around us watching us. They gave us food, a blanket, a towel, toothbrush, soap, and then we were sent to a room. They showed us the rooms and all that. The next morning, a doctor came to give us all a medical review. They gave us some pills, and that was it. I took them without knowing what they even were. Inside the center, it's like a prison. There are bunk beds, one on top of the other. There are no sanitary conditions, and bathrooms are terrible. It's horrible. Also, the blanket and towel, everything smelled awful, and the cell was cold inside because it was January. The cold was unbearable. It was dark because in our section, the lights weren't working.
La manta, la toalla, todo esto apestaba. Y la celda dentro hacía un frío porque era enero, hacía un frío que no.
In the mornings, they would take us out to the yard for half an hour to an hour, but that was never enough. Basically, half an hour. And then inside again. Bored, we would play cards or something else to get distracted. That was all. Then we went to bed to sleep. You see the world from a different perspective in that place.
Aburrido. Nosotros jugamos a cartas, a juego para distraernos. Nada más. Y después a la cama, a dormir. Ahí dentro tú ves el mundo diferente.
Cuando estuve en Senegal, yo me.
When I was in Senegal, I thought I was living in a paradise. But then, soon after I arrived, I faced huge problems and difficulties. I would ask myself why I didn't stay in my country, in my own country. The day we arrived on the island of Del Hierro, a lawyer came and told us that we had nothing to be worried about. She said she was there to help us, and that she was our lawyer, but that was the last time we saw her since we got off the ship near Tenerife. The policemen had their offices there in the building, and the Red Cross came to assist some of us who were sick. There were 16 people to a room. We had bunk beds. It was the raining season. It rained all the time, which completely flooded the room. Life was very hard there.
In ese momento llovía, y cada vez que llovía, el dormitorio se llenaba de agua y todo. Digamos, una vida difícil, ¿eh?
It's a hostile place, a place where you feel really alone. The cell door is open because there's a yard. The mattress was made of plastic. Blankets smell terribly. The water was cold and the food, something basic, very basic. For breakfast, bread, butter, and milk with cold coffee. Nothing hot was available. While you ate your meal, the cameras watched you. The police would watch you from the other side. You can't take anything with you back to the room. It's forbidden to have a mobile phone. And if you want to make a phone call, you have to pay. The prices charged for things are extremely high, and everything around you is destroyed. Even with a daily cleaning service that disinfects everything, it's impossible to sit on a toilet. It's impossible to take a shower or even try to. I used to put a trash bag on the floor, the only one we were given, so as not to have any direct contact with the floor. 10 days later, I received a letter saying that I was going to be released because someone had requested a pardon of my sentence, which was delivered in Madrid. Once it was received in Madrid, they released me.
It was a normal day. I was heading out to see my girlfriend when a car pulled up next to me. It was the police asking for my ID. I said I had nothing on me, and so they took me to the police station. They took my fingerprints, gave me an order of deportation, and took me to Algeciras, to the CIE of Algeciras, preparing to send me back to my country. The detention center of Algeciras is like a living hell. No human being deserves to live the way they live there.
Ningún ser humano merece vivir de esa forma de lo que está haciendo ahí.
It is well known migration law establishes that detention centers can't have a prison nature. But let's not fool ourselves. The detention center of Algeciras is the old prison of Algeciras. The prison was closed because, surprisingly, it didn't pass the required conditions to house people that were there serving a prison term. And I say surprisingly because if it was not appropriate to house prisoners, apart from having to serve a sentence according to our Spanish constitution, how is it now appropriate to house these people who have only committed an administrative infringement?
Sí puede servir para aquellas personas que exclusivamente han cometido una infracción administrativa.
Primero tú llegas.
When you first arrive, they frisk you, and before that, they provide you with documents setting out your rights, and in Spanish, French, English, for those who speak other languages. If you don't speak those languages, it means nothing to you. After that, they give you a towel, like they do here, only dirtier, dirtier. The worst thing is the toilets. They smell very bad, and also food is impossible to eat. It's not the way to treat a human being. There's no reason to treat us like that. I get very angry because of that. The police officers are very violent there. They do everything there with brutality. They tell you, you go there, come here, make a line. And they do it while beating you and beating other people. And it hurts. It really hurts. I remember one day we were having lunch, and there was a guy, I don't know what he did, something with the food, yes. The officer told him to sit down in a certain place, but he said he wanted to go somewhere else. Then the officer said no, and came to him, and they were beating and beating him so bad that his back swelled up. The thing is that they have the last word, and we have to do whatever they say. Nobody can talk. There was a child crying and shouting who was running under a table. Then the officer grabbed him by the hand and started beating him. That's not right.
It is established by law that we have to be there. But to be honest, the only work we do there is surveillance. The only thing that we can say on behalf of the National Police Department, by judicial decree, we have to watch the people who are in the detention centers for immigrants. But they have all their rights, except for the right to freedom. We don't have any power at all to change things. We only have the duty to enforce the law. That's our job. I don't understand at all why a police officer would want to intentionally harm or cause physical damage to inmates. A police officer earns 1,600 euros a month, so it would be really stupid to harm someone by doing so endanger his economical stability, the stability of his family and his livelihood. As in every other job, a police officer makes mistakes, but that's what laws are for. Criminal law is not aimed at police officers, but the internal regulations are actually stricter than the criminal law. There are isolated problems, but it is one case out of a thousand. There are also the rogue inmates, and I think it's logical to detainees that if you present a report against a police officer, that is, the person in charge of their surveillance, they can delay or even avoid their deportation out of Spain. We are allowing, I mean the law is allowing, this practice and it's terrible.
Estamos dando, las leyes están dando lugar a esta picaresca y esto es tremendo.
Pero también hay que tener en cuenta otra realidad.
But we should realize that many, or at least some of the detainees, come across from other penitentiaries where violence might have been used to try to obtain more freedom or better conditions.
Para intentar obtener o bien supuesta libertad.
In those places, I have seen handmade guns produced by the inmates. It's scandalous. I've seen spikes made out of a toothbrush, even chain sticks made also of toothbrush. I mean, you can find anything.
If you are thinking that the way these places operate is complicated, Conrado's case is much harder to understand. A young man born in Spain who, after 30 years, received an order to be deported out of his own country.
I was sent to the detention center due to a low-level case of drug dealing. I served 3 years in the prison at the penitentiary center of Mansilla de Leon. On my last day, my mother came to look after me, and when I came out, I found the national police waiting there for the purpose of deporting me to Cape Verde, my parents' country. I was born in Bienvivre, a village in Leon, Bierzo. I have been living there my whole life. My parents came from Cape Verde 35 years ago. How is it possible that a person who was born in Spain is sent to a detention center for migrants? The truth is that I don't know why. They say it's because I haven't a Spanish ID card. I've always been here legally. I've always had all my papers in order. I've had a residence permit all this time, but I don't have a national ID card because of a lack of care. You know, I never thought that something like this could ever happen to me, just for not having my ID card. Then I came here to Madrid, to Aluche, and I landed in this center, a place with neither head nor tail. It's the food, the behavior, the sanitary conditions, a bit of everything. It's like being in jail, or perhaps even worse. At least in jail you have a TV or a radio. From your room you can't see anything. You don't see anything, just a piece of the road outside. The view is blocked. The dome blocks the exterior view. When a person first arrives, they have the right to make a phone call to their family. I sometimes asked new inmates if they were permitted to make their phone call, if the guard had let them do it, because people were asking me for money all the time to make phone calls. The thing is that the guard didn't inform them of their rights. Then I had to go personally to tell the guard to let them call. I would tell them, this kid has been here for a week, he has to call his family. This used to happen not only with one inmate, but 15 at a time.
According to the current law, there is a maximum period of stay of 60 days at a detention center for migrants. If you are not deported by that time, you can never be remanded there again.
El día de mi cumpleaños me dieron el billete de avión. Para irme a Cabo Verde. Me llevaron para el aeropuerto.
The day of my birth, I was given a plane ticket to go to Cape Verde. I was taken to Madrid airport. Once I arrived, I was led to an office, and then they forced me into a straitjacket. Of course, I asked them why they were doing that to me. I didn't kill anyone. I was told it was for my own safety. I tied my feet and hands together. When it was time, they escorted me to the plane. When I got off the transfer car, I cried out that I didn't want to board, and I threw myself on the tarmac. The policeman grabbed me. One held me by the neck, another used his knee against my crotch, and a third was trying to suffocate me with the jacket he was wearing. He had it all over my face, trying to suffocate me. Then the captain of the plane came out and refused to let me fly.
I worked in immigrant affairs for a short time. I was there for a year. And sometimes, yes, I had to. A couple of times I had to deport people. We took them to the plane, passed them to the authorities, and then we came back. Minimum physical force is implied to ensure secure, safe conditions. If the person becomes aggressive, of course, you have to act firmly. But if not, there is no need. If a person doesn't want to be deported, he or she won't be deported. Enforcement is not in the power of the police. So deportees take desperate actions. Once, someone stripped naked on the airplane, and the captain feared a scandal, so told us all to get off. That was the end of that deportation. What I mean is that it's logical and humane that a person would use all the resources at their disposal to avoid being deported from this so-called paradise.
The second time they tried to deport me, it was obvious that the officers were angry because the first time they didn't succeed. So the second time they were like, how should I call it, using a lot of psychological pressure. They were insulting me, saying racial insults. I mean, they were beating their chests to scare me. So when I got to the plane and the captain said that he wouldn't let me fly with handcuffs, they got even more pissed off and they brought me here. That was after 55 days of being in the country. So I stayed there 3 extra days and after that they set me free. Well, they didn't really set me free. The thing is that under law, you can't stay for more than 60 days. And I was here for 58 days, and it's hard to find a flight out. So I had reached the time limit of deportation, and that's why they had to let me go. But now I can't work or do anything.
Apart from the human suffering it provokes and being unfair, it's very inefficient because the effective rate of repatriation is very low. Out of all the cases applied, only half result in deportation. And why does that happen? Because either it is people without documents and it's impossible to prepare them, or for other reasons it's not possible to deport that person. An example is with newcomers who come undetected to our coast, especially if they come by pateras, boats, or through the Spanish cities of Ceuta or Melilla.
Sometimes, this situation, you think that these detentions are ordered, knowing that the case will become a deportation that is not possible to be executed.
I think it is part of a prosecution and oppression process to make migrants feel unsafe here and force them to leave. It's also hard to make the various embassies collaborate in the identification of its nationals, because when they are deported, the home country has to recognize the nationality of these people, but in many cases they don't do it. There are also some consulates, like the Algerian one in the city of Alicante, that asks for money to give to the Spanish authorities. In other words, they demand a bribe, and they get it. The bribe is 15 euros if the person is in good health and 20 euros for a pregnant woman or someone that is wounded or hospitalized.
Si era una embarazada o era un herido que había que llevarlo al hospital.
Politically, it's not correct to determine that some deportations are not going to be executed. That's a falsity. Why? Because in the end, you're creating an image in the public eye that migrants are not being deported. I think what should be done with public opinion is some kind of a teaching approach to educate them that yes, we try to deport them, but sometimes we can't.
Humanitarian organizations like SOS Racism are trying to stop deportations with specific actions in airports.
We're informing the passengers on the flight to Dakar at 1750 that there's going to be an expulsion on their flight, to inform the crew that they can oppose this kind of action. The passengers can take action too. They can refuse to fly while there's a person being deported on their flight. They can refuse to take a seat and so on. This way, it might be stopped.
In order to deport these people, a commercial flight can be used. You know what I mean, a flight of tourists. The flights for Marco deportations are done by Air Europa, and there's a campaign against it because the company has signed a contract for 12 million euros. Those flights are very difficult to detect because they are planned in advance and involve the consulates of the home countries, the airline, and the Interior Ministry, which is responsible for the payment and arrangement of flights. On those flights, people are not able to offer any resistance because there are no civilians to witness what goes on, and so the police brutality was intense. Many deportees were beaten, and so it was better not to resist because they would deport you by all means.
I wish there was a world without borders. It's a utopian idea. Unfortunately, due to all the different resources and people who want to protect the riches at their disposal, divisions and borders are created.
It's written in law that the state has control of its borders and the people from foreign countries living in their territories. That said, if I'm asked about the current model of the detention centers, clearly I will say I don't like it. What I think, though, is that they will remain, whether we like it or not.
As a police officer, I wish there were no jails or detention centers for immigrants, or CIEs. If a person or NGO comes and tells me that they are against CIEs, I will say that as a police officer, I also disagree. But I would ask that person to find a solution to that problem, because criticizing is easier than actually solving the problem.
I think that history will judge us very harshly for restricting the freedom of migrants, and especially for applying it in Spain. Even if it's an exceptional measure, it's been applied in an arbitrary way because it's not done as a sole remedy. Around 1,000 people are sent to detention centers every month. It can't be considered an exceptional measure.
Corruption and the way they rule. It's said that in Africa there are dictators, but in my opinion, in Europe there are dictators as well.
I just wanted to avoid what is behind, you know?
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of iRab English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. In the Holy Quran, Surah An-Nisa, Ayah 32, we read, "Do not covet the advantage which Allah has given some of you over others. To men belongs a share of what they have earned, and to women a share of what they have earned. And ask Allah for His bounty. Indeed, Allah has knowledge of all things."
من یه نمونه براتون بگم. تو هواپیما بودم، یه مهماندار خواهر بزرگواری.
Once when I was traveling on an airplane, a female flight attendant came to me and asked me a question. She asked, "I have been married recently, but I can't establish a happy relation with my husband. I also can't have a good sexual relation with my husband. What do you think the main reason is?" I said, "My straight answer is that you replaced your private and public belongings as a woman and wife. You are happy with your male colleague and laugh all the time, but you are cold with your husband. In other words, you are like a stranger to your husband and like a non-stranger to your colleague, and this is wrong." Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about our program on Call of Islam page, iRab English Radio, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A study involving almost 3.4 million people with diverse ancestries has identified thousands of genetic variants associated with tobacco. This study has recently been published in the scientific publication Nature. Stay tuned for more. More than 3,500 genetic variations that potentially affect the smoking behavior have been identified in a study involving almost 3.4 million people with African, American, East Asian, and European ancestry. The findings, published in Nature on December 7th, highlight how increasing the sample size and ethnic diversity improves the power of such genome screening analysis, called genome-wide association studies, to reveal how various traits are linked to genes, combination of genes, or mutations. Smoking is an important risk factor for several physical and mental illnesses, including cardiovascular diseases and psychiatric disorders. Although this behavior is influenced by environmental and social factors, there is evidence that genetics can affect tobacco consumption. We are at a stage where genetic discoveries are being translated into clinical applications, says a study co-author Daijing Liu, a statistical geneticist at Penn State College of Medicine in Hershey, Pennsylvania, adding, "If we can forecast someone's risk of developing nicotine dependence using this information, we can intervene early and potentially prevent a lot of deaths." Scientists use GWAS to find genetic ties to diseases or behaviors by comparing genetic sequences in large numbers of people. But so far, most of these studies have focused on European populations. Liu and his colleagues constructed a model that incorporated the genomic data of 3,383,199 people, 21% of whom had non-European ancestry. They identified 3,823 genetic variants that were associated with smoking behavior. 39 of these were linked with the age at which individuals started smoking, 243 with the number of cigarettes smoked per day, and 849 with the number of cigarettes per week. Of the total number of associated variants, 721 were identified only by the multi-ancestry GWAS and not by an ancestry-naive model that the authors used for comparison. This suggests that large and diverse population samples significantly increase the power of such studies. The researchers found that the majority of genetic associations for smoking have similar effects across the different ancestries. We also find similar heritability estimates for the trait across the ancestries, suggesting that, generally, the genetic architecture of these behaviors is similar across ancestries, says Gretchen Saunders, a psychologist at the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, and co-author of the paper. However, they also showed that polygenic risk scores based on a combination of multiple genetic factors that were specific to the European ancestry group were poor predictors of smoking in other ancestry groups. The similarity across ancestries could be partly because the vast majority of non-European cohorts included in the study live in the U.S. and therefore have similar environmental influences, such as public health policies and the availability of nicotine products, says Anonu Chaudhry, a geneticist at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. Epigenetic and environmental factors are really important to turn off and turn on the genes. So maybe it's because of that reason there aren't many significant differences, adds Sehime Temel, who studies medical genetics at Bursa University in Turkey. The analysis also didn't include people from the West Asia region and Indian populations, in which smoking is often prevalent. Tobacco use is very common in West Asia. There is a huge consumption of this product. The researchers acknowledge that their sample does not capture global diversity in genetic ancestry or geography. While being the largest and most ancestrally diverse study of smoking phenotype so far, it has not covered all populations, says Leo, adding, in future phases of the study, we'll welcome collaborations from other investigators who have access to additional databases to further expand our studies.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami, dini wa'adhu ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about banking in this episode and the upcoming episodes, hopefully, or inshallah, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we start our program, let's take a listen to a short biography.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. The topic that we're going to focus in this episode and the episodes to come, inshallah, will be, banking and all about financial matters. Let me ask you with this question, Sheikh Javid, is it necessary, is it incumbent on a person who borrows money from the banks? And we know today this is something like an epidemic in today's society, in modern life. You can't find anyone without any borrowing from any banks today.
You can't help it.
Yeah, you can't help it. And so we are talking about, and we are focusing on those people who borrow monies from the banks, right? Any sums of money from the banks. Is it necessary for them? Is it obligatory for these people, basically the borrowers, the money borrowers, to ask the permission of authorized religious authorities or any one of their agents, right?
Yes.
Especially when the bank, for example, demands or asks for a payment of anything extra like a riba, right?
Yes.
So is it permissible to borrow without any pressing need also?
Well, that's a very good question. I would like to say that generally speaking, borrowing money does not require the permission of an authorized religious authority or a qualified jurist. Even if the money is borrowed from a state bank, so the loan contract per se is valid, even if it is based on what we call riba or usury. Mm-hmm. We know that riba is absolutely haram and it is forbidden under mm-hmm. all circumstances.
Right.
We cannot sign a contract on riba or based on riba. However, if a contract is signed, the contract is valid. And Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if the loan is a riba-based loan, of course, he says that as a matter of religious duty, it is haram to embark on such contracts, irrespective of whether you get it from a Muslim or a non-Muslim, or whether you get it from an Islamic state or a non-Islamic state. It doesn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, let me add to it. Let me add one thing, and that is, of course, we can. If you are getting a loan from a non-Muslim bank, of course, there is no objection to a Muslim stipulating or placing a condition in the contract,
mm-hmm.
placing a condition for a surcharge or for an additional amount, because it's permissible. It's always permissible to receive, interest from non-Muslims. So let me also conclude that whether it is permissible or not to get the permission of a religious mujtahid, of course, as I mentioned, and it's not necessary to obtain the permission of a religious authority or a jurist, and of course, if a religious authority, let's say, gives a permission, it doesn't mean that the haram borrowing mm-hmm. of money can become halal,
yes,
simply because the mujtahid has permitted or has authorized. And of course, indeed, there is no case for permitting it. And the religious authority, no religious authority, no mujtahid, in fact, allows a riba-based contract. And of course, we can say that the permissibility of a riba-free loan, of course, we know that there are two kinds of loans. One is riba-free, or the other is, interest-based or mm-hmm. usury-based. So yes. When it comes to the riba-free loan, there is no need for any mujtahid, and one does not have, and the contract of riba does not hinge on the permission or permission of a religious authority, and it's not there's no need for any permission whatsoever.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about banking and financial matters according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh Javid, you talked about usury and riba, which is obviously haram according to the Islamic teachings and Sharia. But there is a little interest that the banks ask you actually to pay after you borrow some money or loans from the banks, right?
Yes.
And the reason or the justification for that extra amount, the demand, is that they need to pay their own bank clerks and staff or personnel.
Yes.
What about that? Is that considered a kind of usury?
Well, the money received by the banks can be part of an agreement signed between the between the bank and the recipient,
mm-hmm.
and there might be a halal contract,
right.
Due to which the money received by the bank can become halal. For example, there are different forms of contract, like a silent partnership or partnership, which is called musharaka, and the mm-hmm. first one is called mudaraba. And then there is also another contract which is called ju'ala. So ju'ala is a kind of contract in which you give money to someone to do something for you. Now, if the additional amount or if the extra amount is received by the bank or maybe by the depositor, whoever the depositor is, as part of this contract, there is no problem in it, and there is no harm in these kind of transactions.
What about the extra amount paid in addition to the original amount that you have to return to the bank after you borrow?
And that's what I said.
Talking about the partnership, whether it is silent or else.
Yes.
You know, I'm talking about the loans that you borrow, but you still need to pay a little extra amount in addition to the original amount.
You're right. Of course, if there's no such contract or those partnership or something like that, then if it is called a kind of loan based on interest,
mm-hmm.
then this transaction is haram, and it's not permissible for the bank to receive the additional amount, no matter what the excuse, okay? Because it's riba, and riba is forbidden under all circumstances. However, if for example, there is no such condition placed, there is no such stipulation for interest, and the client, let's say that the person who receives money, gives some extra amount with his own consent, without the bank requiring him to give,
mm-hmm.
there is no problem, because it's a kind of compensation for the devaluation or depreciation of the money paid to him by the bank.
But it shouldn't be stipulated
first
contract.
Yeah, of course, it shouldn't be stipulated.
Uh-huh, I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRAB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Russia says the eastern city of Donetsk has come under the most intense shelling by Ukraine since the start of the war.